Shrink Wrap Radio number 418, How to Be an Adult in Love, with Dr. David Rico.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is clinical psychologist and spiritual teacher, Dr. David Rico, who is also the author of How to Be an Adult in Love, Letting Love In Safely and Showing It Recklessly. You can find out more about Dr. David Rico by visiting our show notes for this episode on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. David Rico, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you. Actually, you were suggested as a guest by one of my listeners, and I was shocked that you've written so much and that I was unaware of your work, even though we're both located in the Bay Area. So I was surprised and delighted to discover you and your work, and really happy to have you on the show.
Well, thanks, Dave.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your background, you know, how you got into becoming a psychotherapist, where you went to school, because a lot of the people who listen are students, either wannabe students, students in process, former students, et cetera. So tell us a bit about your pathway into psychology and where you went to school and graduate school and how you got interested in Jung and Buddhism and all of that.
I began by going to a Catholic seminary, and I was ordained a priest in 1966.
Ah.
And then I left the priesthood to be married, and that's when I found Jung and Buddhism, and I concentrated on that and got my license as a psychotherapist.
Okay, that makes a certain kind of sense to me.
Yeah.
Having read your book. And where did you get your PhD?
I went to Fairfield University in Connecticut, which is a Jesuit university. That's where I got my master's. Mm-hmm. And then my doctorate was a combination of going to Boston University, where I did the coursework. And then I got involved in a university without walls here in called Sierra University here in California.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got my PhD.
Okay. Well, boy, you have really you've really earned your stripes. It looks to me like this might be your 16th book, How to Be an Adult in Love. Am I right about that? It's about 16?
I think it's 13, because some are repeated, or, you know, revised.
Okay. Well, that's still a very impressive number, and you're still going, right?
Yes. My new one is going to be called The Power of Grace, and that comes out in October.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we will be looking forward to that. And your work is very informed by both the Jungian perspective and the Buddhist perspective. And in the preface of your book on How to Be an Adult in Love, you say that writing is part of your spiritual practice. I thought that was very interesting. How so?
I consider it a way of making a contribution to the health and spirituality of others by sharing what comes through to me. And so in that sense, it feels like a spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm. And how about the discipline of writing? I mean, to me...
I actually enjoy it, so it's not really a discipline.
Okay. And so we are going to be discussing what I think is your most recent book, which is How to Be an Adult in Love.
Mm-hmm.
And are you implying by that title that it's tough for us to take a grown-up approach to our relationships?
Yes. Well, my other book is How to Be Adult in Relationships, and this is a follow-up based on the Buddhist practice of loving-kindness, in which we show love not only in relationships, but to ourselves first, then in relationships, then to the people that we have difficulties with, and then finally to all beings. Hence, it's a more spiritually oriented book than How to Be Adult in Relationships.
Yes, because I certainly got that it was very spiritually oriented. On the face of it, one would think that giving and receiving love would be the simplest and the most natural of things, but most of us encounter challenges along the way. What's up with that?
The main thing that gets in the way, as far as I can see, is our ego, which is a kind of self-centeredness that it's hard to be free of. And in that self-centeredness, we believe that we're entitled to special treatment, and that if people hurt us, we can retaliate. This is also called a big ego, or a kind of arrogance. And the way I see it is that is the main obstacle to the kind of giving and receiving that happens in a love relationship, where you have to go outside yourself to the other person.
You know, incidentally, speaking of that entitlement and arrogance, one of my colleagues at Sonoma State University was under the impression that a sense of entitlement seems to be on the increase. That's what she was experiencing in her teaching over the years, that it seemed like more and more students came into it with a sense of entitlement. This is a little bit of a divergence from your book, but I wonder if you have any impression about that.
Yes, I can see how that would fit, because, you know, we brought up this generation to have so much and to believe that what they have is something they're entitled to and don't really have to work for, which wasn't quite the perspective in my own childhood and growing up.
Right, nor in mine. I really like in your book, it's very rich with wonderful phrases. I think it must come from your Buddhist orientation, sort of like they're almost Zen-like terms of speech. And one that I really like was, you write that in your introduction, you write that the love in us arises from an innate goodness. And something about that really resonated for me. I guess because, you know, deep down somewhere in myself, I feel like I'm good. And not that I'm perfect in any way, but I hadn't linked love with that sense of innate goodness. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about that.
I'm a believer that every person has an innate goodness, and that the more we are loved, the more does it come out. And St. Augustine has an interesting statement. Everything we do for good, even sin. So we're always moving in the direction of what we imagine to be good for ourselves. And I'm adding to that a recognition that we also happen to have true goodness in us, but it's always up to us to make the choices that manifest it, because we also have a shadow side, a dark side that militates against the goodness and makes it possible for us to choose paths that aren't in our best good or for the best good of others. So just having the goodness is a wonderful thing, but it doesn't really make much difference if we don't make the choices that support it and mirror it into the world.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense to me. I also love the turn of phrase when you say love sits in us someplace between trust and fear. Maybe you can say a bit about that.
We trust in a relationship when we notice that the other person is trustworthy, and at the same time, the closeness that follows from the trust might be scary to us, because closeness is associated with fear. We're afraid if we get too close or let the other person get too close, we might lose our personal freedom. We might be absorbed in the other person. We mm-hmm. might be engulfed.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's hardly any relationship that doesn't include some kind of fear. Or you could also have the fear of being abandoned by the other because you don't yet fully trust that the other will really stay with you through thick and thin.
Yeah.
So that's what I meant by most relationships happen somewhere between trust and fear.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very compact, but it says a lot. What's the relationship between love for oneself and love for the other?
How do you mean? You mean different kinds of love? Or?
Well, actually, this is something I think that you discussed at some length in the book. Isn't there a way that they feed each other, that the ability to love oneself feeds the ability to love the other, and love for and from the other feeds the ability to love oneself?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, they interact and mirror each other. Basically, I'm proposing that love means or is expressed by five very particular styles of behavior, which I call the five A's, since they all begin with A. You pay attention to the other, to his or her feelings and intuitions and so forth. You accept the other just as he or she is. You appreciate, you show affection physically and appropriately, and at the same time, you allow the other person to make the choices that he or she needs to make, even if one of the choices is to leave you. So those same five A's you could apply to yourself. I pay attention to my own needs and feelings and advocate for myself with regard to them. I accept myself as I am rather than judge myself or feel ashamed or guilty when it's not appropriate. I appreciate myself. I take care of myself affectionately, and I allow myself to make the choices that are based on my deepest needs and wishes. And when I do that for myself, it's more easy to do it for someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that five A's schema that you develop in the book, and it becomes a kind of motif that you pick up in relation to several topics as one moves through the book, and we'll probably have reason to touch back on that again. I wanted to highlight another one of these very pregnant little phrases in your writing where you say, "True love makes everyone irresistible." Perhaps mm-hmm. you can unpack that one for us.
I'm referring to the loving kindness practice, which is one of the main practices in Buddhism, in which you beam out love and aspirations for happiness for yourself and others. And when you do this, it makes everyone more appealing because you see them all as in your circle of love.
That's quite an achievement.
It's a big achievement. That's why it's called a practice. And you do this on a daily basis, mm-hmm. and gradually you just do it automatically.
Yeah.
It's having a kindly attitude and behavior toward others, even when they're people that you don't even know or even people that you don't like. And you try to find a way to come across to them with loving kindness.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I've noticed, and I know many people have noticed, is there have been people that initially I was very turned off to, and somehow later on got to know their story. And once I knew their story, it totally transformed my perception.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody has a story. has mm-hmm. been my experience. And sometimes I guess part of what you're talking about is assuming that to be true and kind of knowing at some level that that's true.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
I also love the subtitle of your book, which is Letting Love In Safely and Showing It Recklessly. And I think that line condenses quite a bit. So tell us about the recklessly part.
In other words, the extent of the love is recklessly universal instead of selective. And once you say this, that would mean that the real love is unconditional. It's not based on the appeal that the other person has. It's based on just the fact of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
And once it's also understood that everyone has this goodness within, then everyone is appealing on that basis.
Yeah.
Even though the goodness is hard to see in some people. So that's the challenge part.
Yeah, it is. I really appreciate your humility that comes across in the book when you say that while you draw on your psychological training and your spiritual training and your own life experience, at the same time you resist any pat explanations about either love or, well, particularly about love, and that ultimately there is a mystery there. So kind of your book is a set of guidelines really in that way, but you back off of saying this is how it really is.
Well, thank you for noticing that. I do see it as mainly a mystery. All these things, like, you know, love, caring, trust, fear. And we only approach each of these topics. There's no final formulation that would, shall we say, settle it once and for all as to what something really is. Kind of like poetry. No one could actually define it. You could describe it in various ways. You could say it has rhythm. You could say it has economy of words. You could say it brings out connotations instead of denotations. It has metaphors and images to convey a particular sense or mood, etc. You could say all that, but you still wouldn't ever quite know what it is fully, because it's a way that the realm of mystery has touched into human writing and creativity. And so I'm very respectful of that dimension of things.
Yeah.
I suppose it goes all the way back to my original religious experience, because obviously, religion is full of mysteries. There's no final way of saying what God is, what the Holy Spirit is, why things are the way they are, whether there's an afterlife. All those kind of questions are way too big to have some ultimate and knock-em-dead response. No pun intended.
Yeah, I think the reason I lit up to that is because I share that kind of feeling with you, and I like your poetry example, and it also puts me in mind of Louis Armstrong famously said about jazz, where he didn't attempt to explain it. I think he just said something, you know, to the effect of, you recognize it when you hear it, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, my depth psychology intern, Eric, is here, as I mentioned, and he was raised in Catholicism, and we recently spoke with Matthew Fox. And so, Eric, I want to invite you to just jump in here. If you resonate to anything as you hear David talking about his Catholic background and training, where it's taken him.
Actually, what I was kind of thinking a bit about were more along the lines of obstacles and loving, and really the role of complexes I guess how to bring awareness to some of the fears and obstacles one might face.
Okay, good. We'll lob that one at you.
Okay. One of my books is called When the Past is Present. And in that book, I describe how the past, in other words, what happened to us in childhood, has a direct effect on our relationships and can provide many obstacles to the full-on closeness or commitment, because we carry some baggage from childhood or from our very first relationship, which was with our parents. And if we weren't given those 5 A's by them, because those 5 A's of love are also the original needs we came into the world with, if they were given to us, then it'll be fairly easy to have a healthy relationship, because we've received something that has been given to us so appropriately that now we are, shall we say, able to give it to others. And then when they weren't given to us, then we feel like there's something missing, and we try to get too much of it from others. Anyway, the obstacles surround those 5 A's. For instance, if I didn't get enough attention, I might be looking for too much attention from a partner.
Yeah, in a way, the 5 A's is a very compact way of working with some of the ideas relating to attachment theory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. In fact, they talk about that in the book.
Yeah. You have various practices that you recommend throughout the book, and you emphasize that you're not exactly talking about practice in the sense of developing a skill. It's more in the sense of a Buddhist practice. So please tell us something about what you do mean.
I'm a little unclear. I mean, you mean like what is a practice? Or
Yeah, exactly. And particularly in the context of the practices that you recommend in the book.
I see it as daily practice, and I have very specific ones in the book.
Mm-hmm.
The main one is the loving kindness practice. Another one is mindfulness.
Yes.
And basically what we're trying to do is alter the way our brain processes things. So we start treating people differently from the way we used to. And I'll give a simple example of a practice that I use.
Good.
When people used to cut me off in traffic, like on the freeway,
yeah,
highway, I would get very upset. And, of course, that was my ego reacting, because how dare they cross my path in that cutting off way? Don't they realize that I'm a big shot? And so I thought to myself, well, that's all ego. That road rage is just your ego getting upset by not getting the respect you think you deserve. But that is not really helping you or anybody else. So I started the practice of whenever they cut me off, I take my foot off the accelerator and I say, may you arrive safely, may you not cause any harm, may you find Buddha's path. And I've been doing that now for several years. Now I do it automatically because I practiced it and I no longer have the road rage.
That's a great example. As you mentioned, the first practice in relation to love that you advocate is to bring mindfulness to it. And we hear so much about mindfulness these days in a very general way, but in your book, you actually break down the components of mindfulness very specifically. Now, I know it's been a while since you wrote the book. It's probably been a year at least, so I don't know if you remember the details that you spell out, but tell us a bit about the steps or the specifics of mindfulness, if you will.
It's basically basically a practice of staying in the here and now, noticing the judgments, fears, desire to be in control, attachment to outcome that keeps interfering with your being in the here and now, and simply noticing them and just letting them go rather than entertaining them. And you would do this in a sitting position, or you could do it throughout the day. So, for instance, if you're thinking of some experience that just happened and you start to judge yourself about it or wish you had done it differently, in other words, you're kind of embroidering around the events with all this mental stuff, mental chatter, you would notice that and say, oh, those are interfering thoughts, and let me just come back to the pure event, the pure reality of what happened, and just be with it as it is, without the embroidery around it. And there's something about doing that that puts you in touch with the reality of the situation rather than your mental picture of it.
Right.
An example I use of the difference between reality and a mental picture is very simple. I use the example of a menu. You go into the restaurant and you open up the menu. The menu says spaghetti and meatballs. You picture in your mind the best way that spaghetti and meatballs can be prepared. You think to yourself, it's a homemade sauce with fresh tomatoes, and it's been made with beef, ground beef turned into meatballs that have flavored the sauce. The macaroni, the spaghetti itself will be al dente, and the sauce will be on top of it. And there will be two or three meatballs at the side of the plate. So that's your mental picture of what it is. And it's a good mental picture because that is what it would be about. But when it actually arrives, it's overcooked macaroni with ketchup on it with a couple of hamburgers on the side, because that's what that's the mental picture of the chef, which doesn't match your mental picture. But that is the reality. So you're disappointed because the reality doesn't match your picture of it. That would be a great example of exactly what mindfulness is aiming at. How could you line up the reality and the picture? And the way you do that is by clearing away all the beliefs about what it's supposed to look like and go directly to what does it actually look like. So to go back to our analogy, you could, when you open up the menu and it says spaghetti and meatballs, you could say to the waiter, what does this include? What does it look like? And then he will tell you. And even then, you're taking a chance, but you certainly have a better image in your mind of what it's about, and then you can make an intelligent choice based on what it's actually about. Follow what I mean?
Yeah, I do. It's a great example because I've had that experience of disappointment. And I think it's no accident that you choose that example, because I think somewhere in your book I encountered something that suggested that you're of Italian extraction.
Yes, I am.
So you do have some expectations about spaghetti and meatballs.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You have a chapter on how we can love ourselves, and this is a challenging thing for many people. What's your advice to listeners out there who may be struggling with this?
What I recommend first is to give yourself those 5 A's. Like, how can I pay attention to myself more? Can I accept myself just as I am? How can I appreciate myself, and that means value myself? How can I allow myself to make the choices that really fit for me? And how can I take care of myself affectionately?
Okay, great. That's a great start. And I also wanted to go back to, we were talking earlier about the fear of love as being sort of one point, one extreme of a continuum. And you note that most of us fear love as much as we want it, and that we fear both the receiving and the giving of full-on love. How do you recommend we work with our fear of love?
I see the fear going in two directions, as I mentioned before. One is the fear of abandonment. If you go away, I'll be sad and alone, and maybe I won't even survive. And if you get too close, I won't survive because you will smother me. So those are the two fears, the fear of engulfment or the fear of abandonment. Those are the two main fears that I've been able to recognize. And you work with these fears by allowing someone to go away 1 minute longer than you can stand and to get 1 inch closer than you can stand. And when you do this over and over, that's the practice. Gradually, the fear lifts.
What's the difference between the kind of self-love that you're talking about and narcissism?
In self-love, you give yourself these five A's in an appropriate way. And in narcissism, you're deeply self-centered and you're unable to love yourself appropriately or others. So the narcissist is too self-enclosed to make the journey out of him or herself to show love.
When it comes to self-love, I'm wondering if there's a bit of a paradox between accepting oneself more or less as one is and on the other hand, striving for some kind of Buddhist perfection.
Well, we don't talk as much about perfection in the Buddhist style. It's more like you're already perfect, you're already enlightened, and now you want to acknowledge that and act in accord with it. What does it mean to be enlightened? That you make your decisions on the basis of loving kindness, no longer in the grip of fear or craving.
Okay. As a Jungian-oriented psychotherapist, you're very attentive to the role of the shadow, and I think that came up earlier in one of your answers. How do shadow dynamics play into learning to love oneself?
The shadow refers to the disavowed or repressed traits in our personality. We don't want to acknowledge them. So instead, we project them as unacceptable onto others. So, for instance, let's say deep down you're a controlling, manipulative person, but you have never accepted that fact about yourself because you've repressed it, disavowed it, tried to dissociate from it. But when you see someone else being manipulative or controlling, you get very upset and you judge that person and you become angry at that person. But what you're actually doing is you're showing the anger or judgment toward that person that is really about yourself. So the way to work with the shadow in yourself is just to list all the ways in which you, all the things in other people that you strongly dislike, and then ask yourself, how many of those are actually true of you? You'll probably say none of them. So you would have to show that list to someone you could trust and say, do you see any of this in me?
Mm-hmm.
That's the negative shadow. The positive shadow, that is made up of the virtues that you haven't believed that you actually have, like courage. So instead you project that out to others by admiring them. So what you strongly admire in others might be what's hidden in yourself. So you could do the same kind of list and say, oh, these are the virtues that I have inside me, and I want to work on expressing them.
Yeah, and that comes into play, too, in romantic love, doesn't it, where we are projecting those virtues onto our potential partner?
Yes, exactly. In fact, romantic love is totally based on the positive shadow.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing only the positive features of the other person. You don't see the negative shadow that is also present.
I wonder why we get such a big hit of endorphins or whatever it is when we're going through that, what's called infatuation.
Well, it's probably nature's way of having us get together.
And oh, procreate. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. And, you know, earlier you referred to the brain and to sort of retraining the brain. And you had a section in the book that's has a bit of neuroscience in it. Maybe you can talk to us a bit about the role of mirror neurons and oxytocin in learning to love oneself.
The oxytocin is the hormone that has to do with relatedness. It gives you a good feeling when you're with somebody and feel loved. And the mirror neurons have to do with imitating others. So when others love you, you thereby learn how to love others. A lot of the way we love is based on how we've been loved. When we try to, you know, show that love to others, that was shown to us.
Mm-hmm. What are the practices you recommend in learning to love oneself?
It's the giving of those five A's to yourself.
We all have a deep need to be loved, but how do we learn not to come across as needy? I remember years ago, during the encounter group movement days in the middle 60s, and some people in a group would just, they would be so needy, like a bottomless pit, that pretty soon the group would just sort of tend to shun them. So, you know, we have a deep need to be loved, but it can be terribly off-putting to others if we come across as needy. How does a person who maybe is in that place find some kind of balance?
The neediness goes back to what you didn't receive in childhood now becomes a bottomless pit.
Mm-hmm.
So by very definition of it, it's an incapacity to be fulfilled. So it's a kind of a tragic position to be in, because you wouldn't be able to balance it, because it's just like an open wound, shall we say?
Yeah.
And you will soon notice that people turn away from you when you come at them with that must-have, can't-get-enough energy. And gradually you would realize that you need very deep therapy to explore where that came from and how to give to yourself what your parents failed. Because
mm-hmm.
the neediness is based, it goes directly back to childhood.
And what would the very deep therapy do? How would that address that?
You would address the issue, process it by going through the feelings that are associated with it, and thereby recognize the need for grieving the past and letting go of it, rather than continuing to blame your parents for it.
In your book, you distinguish between three ways of connecting. One you characterize as courteous love, another as intimate love, and then the third as universal love. So maybe you can take us through those three.
I was trying to show that even when you're nice to people, that's a way of being loving, because my definition of love is caring connection. So when you act towards someone with courtesy and civility, kindness, that is the, shall we say, basic level that love exists at. And then in an intimate relationship, which is the next level up, you would show that caring connection in a deeper way. And then finally, in a spiritual way, you would show the loving connection by caring about all people rather than just the ones that you meet up with or the ones that you're in relationship to. So I saw it as three levels of love that you could work with, you know, one to the next.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's feeling love, you know, having an experience of love inside yourself, but that might not always come across. So what's your advice for actually showing love, if you will, in a relationship?
You show it by those five A's: paying attention to the other, accepting the other, showing affection appropriately, appreciating the other rather than taking him or her for granted, and at the same time, respecting the person's boundaries by allowing him or her to come and go in his or her own way.
Okay, and we'll kind of end up sort of where we began, because you early on spoke about showing love everywhere, showing love recklessly. What's your recommendation for showing love everywhere? Again, how would that manifest itself, or what practices could people engage in to enhance that capacity in themselves?
What helps me do that is when I see the news on TV and I see all the things that people are going through in other parts of the world, mm-hmm. I say a little prayer for them or an affirmation, mm-hmm. try to, you know, have a contact of compassion and to look at what's happening in a heartful way rather than just take it as information.
Yeah.
And secondly, find a way to make some kind of contribution, even financially, when there is a terrible need somewhere in the world, like because of all the tragedies, disasters, and violence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that certainly is practical and down to earth. So as we wind down now, is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know?
No, I very much appreciated your questions, and I think they, you know, kind of took us into the main areas in the book. I was going to read the first paragraph of the introduction.
Oh, yes, I forgot I wanted to have you do that. So this would be a good time to do that, because there is a wonderful quality to your writing, and I'd love to have listeners experience that. So go ahead.
Introduction. I begin with a quotation by Emily Dickinson in a letter that she sent to her cousins. "I scarcely know where to begin, but love is always a safe place." And then I begin. "This little life of ours rests between a longing to be loved and a calling to show love. These two stunning possibilities, so tender, so fugitive, are the subject of these pages. I must admit, however, that this is mostly a book of guesses, as any book on love must be. My guess is that loving is what we are here for, that love is what every one of us deserves to receive and is here to give, that love alone makes this earth the heaven it was meant to be."
Well, that's a perfect wrap-up for the interview. And Dr. David Rico, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. And thanks, Eric, also.
Okay, Eric, that's another one in the can here.
Yeah.
So what thoughts or impressions do you have from this interview with Dr. Rico?
Oh, fantastic content here. And I like his book. You know, it seems like a great reference or a guide for maintaining healthy, loving relationships with people.
Yeah.
And I find his five A's, you know, a concise, just a nice little reference point.
Yeah. Kind of, as I mentioned, a template for being very practical and talking about attachment theory ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And you watched a bunch of YouTubes by him, right?
I did. I saw some interviews and book signing talks that he gave, mm-hmm. Regarding a past book of his on trust.
Okay.
Which was equally interesting.
Yeah. Did you say you've read that book or not?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, as you think back more about this interview that we just had, anything else that you particularly note that stands out for you or that you were able to connect to personally?
Well, personally, yes. When you asked me about a connection between Catholicism and love,
yeah,
I actually tripped up a little bit.
Yeah, you didn't go there. You didn't go to the Catholicism part.
Right. In thinking about it, I had difficulty making a connection between Christianity and love based on my early experiences.
Uh-huh.
A lot of my early experiences were fear-based.
Yeah.
At first glance, I didn't really have much on the topic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about as you think about it now?
Thinking about it now, there's definite themes of love, you know, to be experienced in church and in Christianity, and I'm sure that it's preached a lot more than I remember it being. And again, thinking about Meister Eckhart and his emphasis on compassion for others and compassion for oneself, I do see quite a few parallels between David Rico's work and the teachings of Meister Eckhart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. We've had these two interviewees just recently who both have this background in Catholicism, having been trained as priests, and both have made a transition into being very much influenced by Jung. Mm. And I don't know to what extent Du Fox has been influenced by Buddhism. I suspect he has been, and certainly David Rico is very strongly influenced by Buddhism. In fact, he, I believe, is a regular teacher at a Zen, a Buddhist teaching center in Marin County, which is just south of here, called Spirit Rock.
I saw that, yes.
Yeah, so he's done a lot of that kind of teaching.
Right, I saw that David Rico has quite a few workshops that he does, you know, throughout the year.
Uh-huh.
And I see that he lives also in Santa Barbara and in the Bay Area as well. So,
yeah.
You know, studying Jungian studies and hearing David's perspective on the role of shadow was particularly interesting to me as well. And we spoke a little bit about projection.
Right.
And something I was going to mention was thinking about anima and animus projections in romantic relationships, which is more or less our ideal partner, what we feel inside would be our ideal other half.
Right.
So in thinking about projecting an image onto others in romantic love, it seems like a lot of weight to carry if you're that person being loved by someone else's idea.
Yeah. That's an expression I think that I've heard used, you know, like having to carry the projection.
You know, I see that David Rico has written a lot of books.
Yeah, I was amazed.
From his website, I read a little excerpt on his book that has yet to be released. I believe it said it was coming out on October 14th of this year.
Very good.
And it's called The Power of Grace.
Yeah.
Which, it seems that a lot of his topics throughout his books are interconnected, so it seems like a really nice next step in his process.
I wonder what that'll be about. I mean, I think of grace as one of those more spiritual concepts than a psychological concept, per se.
Yes.
What comes to your mind? What do you think he'll have in that book? What would you expect for your spaghetti and meatballs?
Right. What are my expectations?
Yeah.
Actually, quite a few similar themes that I would expect to read in his work on love.
Uh-huh.
You know, grace and compassion and how we work with others and how we communicate with other people.
You mean doing it gracefully?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking of it in terms of God's grace, you know, traditionally as a gift, as a spiritual gift that comes from without, if you will, from above or from without, but maybe it's really from within.
Right, I was coming from a perspective of a practice.
Of being graceful in one's relations, Buddhist ideas of right speech, right livelihood, right?
Right thinking, yes, right speech.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll have to wait until the spaghetti and meatballs actually show up, which is his book on grace. And with that, I think we can wrap it up once again. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is just to let you know that I really appreciate your show, Across the Ocean here in the Netherlands. I've expressed that by a small donation. With regard to the work you put into your shows, it's just a small amount, but it's another way to say I value what you do. I'll keep listening, with heart and mind.
Joris in the Netherlands, thanks so much for sending that endorsement. I hope others will be inspired to become regular supporters. There are actually thousands who are listening to this very episode who are not. So please, help me to keep going. I'm happy to report that we have a new transcript on the site thanks to listener John Eastman. He's transcribed number 374, Exploring the Impact of Internet Pornography on the Brain with Gary Wilson. Thanks so much for that, John. In fact, Gary Wilson got back to me with some fresh research links, which can be found on his site, and one is a link to a Cambridge study, and the other is titled Brain Structure and Functional Connectivity Associated with Pornography Consumption, The Brain on Porn, 2014. I'll put links to both of these in my next Shrink Wrap Radio newsletter, so if you're not a subscriber to the newsletter, you can go on the site and subscribe. You'll see the place to do that in the top of the left-hand sidebar. Also, Gary referred me to a 46-minute YouTube video that references these studies, and you can do a YouTube search for porn on the brain. And this is not a promo for pornography. As you know from recent shows, I'm currently doing some advertising here for Audible.com, which I feel very good about, inasmuch as I've long been one of their customers, and like you, I love getting good audio content. I've got an Audible recommendation for you. Next week's guest is psychologist Dr. Richard O'Connor. I've interviewed him before, and he was great. Well, he's got a new book out, which we'll be discussing on the show. But you can also listen to the whole unabridged book by becoming an Audible.com subscriber. The title of the book is Rewire, Change Your Brain to Break Bad Habits, Overcome Addictions, Conquer Self-Destructive Behavior. You can get this audiobook for free with no obligation to continue by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. Now, they also have audio samples on the site. So let's just sneak a quick listen here to a sample from the new book by Richard O'Connor.
Most of us find ourselves too often repeating the same mistakes, stuck in bad habits, and few of us understand why. Procrastination, lack of assertion, disorganization, smoking, overworking, poor sleep habits, lack of consideration, depressed shopping, internet addiction, all the way up through drug addiction and deliberate self-harm. Generally, we know what we're doing to ourselves and we keep promising to reform. Indeed, we do try often enough, but these habits are hard to break. Every time we try but fail, we become more hopeless and more critical of ourselves. Self-destructive habits like these are the greatest source of unnecessary misery in our lives. Such habits cover the territory from not flossing to suicide, from binge eating to passivity, from the deliberate to the
Okay, well, that gives you just a little sample, and that is read by a professional reader, and I imagine that's read from the very beginning of the book, and it probably gets into a lot more juicy detail as it goes on. And I know my audio capture of it was a little soft, but hopefully if you strained your ears a bit, you were able to get it.
Hi, this is psychologist, psychoanalyst, and political activist Dr. Stephen Solds, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Stephen Solds, for that blast from a past interview. Now let me share a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. Actually, maybe more than a couple. I think I've got four here. The first one is from Karen, who made a donation but did not want to record an endorsement. And she writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm not comfortable leaving an audio recording, but here's a written endorsement. Feel free to use part or all of it and to edit the script. Don't use my last name. Thanks. And I have not edited her script. This is what she writes. She says, I look forward to each episode and usually listen to them on my commute to work or while I'm out walking. I take away valuable insights, and from time to time I've purchased a book that has been mentioned. Thanks for connecting people to quality resources. I especially appreciate that you're open to various points of view and are not promoting any certain brand or philosophical stance. Although my professional experience is outside the mental health and medical fields, I do find that many of the topics that you present are relevant to my growth as an artist and writer. Although my small donation is insignificant alone, I hope others will look forward to each episode and likewise ante up a financial contribution to whatever sum feels comfortable for them. All the best to you, and that's from Karen. Well, Karen, thank you both for your donation and your kind words, and for sending me an endorsement to read on the air. You also requested that I not list you as a donor on the honor roll page on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. I respect your need for privacy and also want to let other potential donors know that they can also request to have their name left off if that's what they wish. My reason for listing names is both to show my gratitude to those individuals by honoring them publicly and also to maybe inspire others to follow in their footsteps. This next one comes from Pete Myron, listener, contributor, men's group leader, and Chicago friend. And he writes, Hello, David. Congratulations on another great podcast, number 416, Donald Kalshed, Trauma and the Soul. Very interesting. I wanted to share briefly a resonation inspired by the interview. I believe you know that I was in group therapy group for 6 years, finishing in 2012. Many of us were childhood trauma survivors, wounded by what you call in the interview bad parenting. Kalshed talks about the dynamic of wounded children often as a strategic retreat to the protective inner world, the mythopoetic realm. As I understand, the upside is it affords a layer of self-keeping from the harsh and harmful reality of their childhood. This is what I experienced and experienced again in the stories of my fellow groupmates. I always had a rich dream life and vivid inner world. I also had plenty of my own maladaptive behaviors in adulthood, as I perhaps lingered too long in this outmoded strategy. I like the idea that protective angels can also become fearful, destructive demons, perhaps keeping us safe prisoners. Throughout my adult life, at least until this last period of therapeutic repair and integration, my dreams have been frequently haunted by menacing evil characters. A big connection for me with the interview. I know of this story told by Tara Brock, Buddhist teacher, psychotherapist, and podcaster, of exactly this process as revealed by one of her clients, a survivor of abuse, in the form of the Blue Fairy. He includes a link to the full text of this fairy tale on Tara Brock's website. Members of group therapy often used and referred to this story because it gave them such a good perspective on their own experience and path to healing. The client reveals the following, quote, The Blue Fairy is telling her she can do something to help. She can do something that will let her forget for a while about the horrible things going on, so she can grow up and handle it when she's stronger. She says she is going to touch different parts of her body with her magic wand, and they will change and be able to hold all those terrible feelings for her. She paused, listening inwardly, and then continued, The good fairy is saying that even though it's hard to be so bound up, it will be her way to survive, to be quiet and control what's happening inside her. Well, the fairy put the little girl's rage and fear into her belly, and then she bound it up so it could stay there. And then she put a magic lock on her pelvis and vagina so her sexual feelings couldn't get her in any more trouble. Rosalie took a few shaky breaths, and I gently asked, What else? Tears began rolling down her cheeks as she said, She told her she'd have to let her rib cage tighten so she wouldn't feel the pain of her heart breaking. Rosalie was quiet, and then she went on, her voice a little stronger. She said her neck would be a fortress with very thick, round walls, so she wouldn't cry out for help or scream out in anger. Rosalie felt quiet, and I just sat with her in silence. "You're doing beautifully," I told her, and then added gently, "Is there anything else the fairy wants you to know?" Rosalie nodded. "She says someday the little girl will no longer be able to hold all this in, and her body will start unwinding its secrets. She will let go of everything she has been holding for so long, and she will do this because most deeply she wants to be whole and real." Rosalie was softly weeping, her shoulders shaking. She just told the little girl not to worry. She would find people who cared and would hold her as she finds herself again. Pete goes on to say, "I believe you will find this connection to Calshad's work quite clear and compelling. I hope you're well, David. I love what you provide me as food for thought. It's always what makes my monthly donation so worthwhile. Best wishes as always, your friend, Pete." Well, Pete, first of all, I apologize for butchering that reading a little bit, but thanks for sharing that fairy tale from Tara Brach. I had not heard it before, and it's a perfect compliment to the Donald Calshad interview. And you didn't know it, but I've actually scheduled Tara Brach for an interview. Next, we hear from listener and sometimes transcriber Gloria Ullman, who has been such a wonderful supporter of my work here. Gloria writes, "Dear David, it's a while since I've actually written, but rest assured I have composed many mental notes of appreciation in the interim. The last several interviews have been particularly enlightening and interesting for me, especially Donald Calshad, Marilyn Schlitz, John Robinson, Matthew Fox, Linda Graham, and Declan Ahern, although each and every one is valuable in its own way. I was thrilled to hear Marilyn Schlitz's interview, as I am a great admirer of Edgar Mitchell and his visionary organization, IONS. I have followed the trajectory of Marilyn's work for many years and greatly respect her work ethic and integrity as a scientist, spiritual seeker, and educator. As a contributor to the Kickstarter program to fund the movie she referenced, Death Makes Life Possible, I was privy to the lengthy process of the making of the film through regular updates and was delighted with the result. It was very well done and a nice balance of science and various religious and non-religious attitudes sprinkled throughout with compelling personal stories. The interview with Donald Calshad was a gem. You had a real rapport going between you, which was evident in his comments at the end of the interview, and I wasn't surprised to hear your comments afterwards that he had been inspired to support your work. It must be a bit of an unknown quantity if you don't know the interviewer and how they are going to receive the kinds of ideas he promotes. I have heard him before, so am not entirely unfamiliar with his approach, but still gleaned much from the interview. I especially liked his take on the self-care defense system that protects the fragility of the psyche from being overwhelmed in the face of potentially soul-shattering or heartbreaking trauma. One of the hardest things I've found for myself in the process of healing the wounds of the past is that becoming conscious takes a great deal of courage because of having to face up to what has been denied and to be able to let go of those protective defenses. I'm also enjoying Eric's input and was deeply moved by his sharing of the very powerful dream he reported in your monthly newsletter. I'm sure he will find Matthew Fox's work and the connection with Meister Eckhart nourishing. As an aside, did you know Eckhart Tolle took his name from Meister Eckhart? It's not common knowledge, but I saw an interview with Tolle once in which he explained it. If I can offer any encouragement, I would say that my deep dive into Christianity, after 30 years of complete rejection of it and professed atheism, has been unimaginably rewarding for me. Jung's integration of spirituality and psychology has been an invaluable help, and the many podcast interviews with Jungians you've had over the years have helped immeasurably in understanding his approach. Reading books is great, but there's nothing quite like hearing the author speak in a real conversation with an empathic soul and intelligent, inquiring mind. I'm really looking forward to your interview with David Rico. I recently downloaded a 3.5-hour audio program of his called Embracing the Shadow. I don't recall how I got onto it because I had never heard of him before, but I was very impressed. The audio was a live recording of a workshop he gave, and his explanations of projection and the difference between shadow projection and transference and countertransference was very thorough and clear. It wasn't available through Audible, and the best price I found was through betterlisten.com. Best wishes, Gloria Ullman. She has a blog, too, at dreammysteries.net, which I think you'll enjoy. Well, Gloria, as always, the depth and wisdom of your emails is always a source of awe for me. And when you hear this, you will also have just heard my interview with David Rico. I hope we lived up to your expectations. Finally, here's one more from my friend Oscar in Stockholm, who writes, I hope I'm not boring you, but here's another one to add to your collection of listener shrink wrap radio synchronicities. I just moved to a new area. A lover of parakeets, I was happy to hear ones chirping from my neighbor's balcony. But it was alone. And in parentheses, he says, wild parakeets live in groups of thousands of birds, close parentheses, and seemingly permanently caged. Caged alone, parakeets invariably uncover a primitive anxiety and a sense of abuse in me. And this one was literally screaming for help, or at least for company. He writes in parentheses, I know the parakeet tongue. Said and done, 10 minutes ago, I wrote a letter to the owners with some kind suggestions and information about the social nature of parakeets and pinned it in the entrance of the house. The very first thing I heard as I came back to my apartment and continued my shrink wrap radio listening was your latest interviewee relating his patient's dream about discovering a caged baby in the pet store. And that's from Oscar. I believe that was in the Donald Calshed interview. Well, good one, Oscar. You know how much I do love those synchronicities. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. And you can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. So thanks again to Dr. David Rico for taking us through the nuances and challenges of adult love. My next episode will feature return guest Dr. Richard O'Connor, whom I interviewed back in episode number 187 and whom I referred to earlier in my Audible.com promotion. This time we'll be discussing his latest book, Rewire: Change Your Brain to Break Bad Habits, Overcome Addictions, Conquer Self-Destructive Behavior, which you can preview on audible.com if you decide to take advantage of the introductory offer I mentioned earlier. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.